from New Orleans. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Not long ago, many of the world's best symphony conductors were notorious personalities. Grumpy, imperious, and rude. Carlos Miguel Prieto remembers one in particular.
So I remember him yelling and spitting at my face at about 2 inches, me doing the waltz from Berlioz's Symphony Fantastique, and saying, "That's not together, it's you. You don't feel the music. What are you thinking? What are you doing?" And things like just barking at you.
But concert halls around the world are experiencing climate change. Dictators are giving way to a warmer and more collaborative kind of conductor. And Prieto is getting plenty of work. He's the music director of 3 major orchestras, including the Louisiana Philharmonic. Carlos Miguel Prieto, after the break. This is the year of Carlos Miguel Prieto. But then, so was last year, and probably next year as well. That's because Carlos Miguel Prieto is a rising tide in classical music, a symphony conductor loved by orchestras and audiences around the world. If the maestro were a U.S. citizen, he might single-handedly lower the unemployment rate. Prieto heads the Orquesta Sinfónica Nacional de México in his hometown of Mexico City, as well as the Youth Orchestra of the Americas, and of course, the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, right here in New Orleans. But that's not all. Prieto is a favorite guest conductor whose most recent calendar dates include appearances in Germany, Britain, New Zealand, China, and Carnegie Hall. He also performs in a family band like no other, the Quartetto Prieto, which features his famous father, Carlos Miguel Prieto Sr., on cello. Part of what makes Maestro Prieto welcome wherever he goes is his wide-ranging repertoire, which includes the usual suspects of symphonic music, but also modern composers who draw inspiration from contemporary events. When we spoke with Maestro Prieto right here at Marini Studios in 2014, we had to congratulate him on his success.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm just thrilled to have you. You know, of all the stories that I have read about you, and I have read many stories about you, my favorite is one that says that you once ran 10 kilometers to a concert hall in Mexico City, that you then conducted a Brahms choral piece, a Brahms violin concerto, Beethoven's 9th choral symphony, and you finished with 2 choral encores before you thanked all the people who participated in the production by name. Now, you're young, but I don't think even, you know, Bruno Mars could pull that off. So where does all that energy come from?
Oh, well, here's the deal. I live part of the year in Mexico City, which is a very, very exciting city. It's a very cosmopolitan city. It's a huge city. But it's a city where anything can happen as far as traffic or things that are unexpected. And this was the last concert of the season of my summer orchestra, which is called Orquesta Sinfónica de Minería, which plays in a beautiful hall in the campus of the university in Mexico City, which is a huge university, 350,000 people.
Whoa!
It's called UNAM, Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. And the last concert is completely sold out and televised not only to Mexico, but all of Latin America, which is it's a very important concert. And we missed, within the preparations of the concert, we missed the fact that all the streets around the hall were going to be closed because of the Mexico City Marathon.
Oh, no.
And they were not really supposed to be closed, but for some reason, the police that day decided to close all the streets that would allow me to get there. So when I saw that there was half an hour or about 40 minutes left before the concert, and I was at a complete standstill in the highway. I said, okay, if I take this exit and just park the car and start running, I may not make it right on time, but I'm going to make it 10, 15 minutes late, which is still acceptable within these extraordinary conditions.
Yes.
So I started running like crazy, but you know, when you don't really measure the distance, but yes, it was about 10 kilometers
away. Oh my goodness.
And when I got to the hall, I was absolutely and completely drenched, because I was already wearing, you know, my tails and everything for the concert.
Wait, you ran in tails?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
This sounds like a movie.
I do weird things. Like, here in New Orleans, I bike to my concerts normally with my tails on, which, you know, to some people is weird, but to me it's liberating to bike to some place and then do a concert of music of Mahler or something, because, you know, you probably get tired physically, but your mind is resting. But on that day, those 10 kilometers were incredibly stressful.
Oh, my
So it wasn't a fun thing. But then when the music starts, you completely forget about everything.
I want to give you $1 million idea.
Okay,
you should get a Nike contract or Puma or Adidas or someone and recreate this situation, running through the streets in your tails as you're heading toward the concert hall. I mean, that's pretty fabulous.
Somehow they probably are more interested in a real sports person and somebody much, much younger than me.
Talk a little bit about Mexico City. As you said, I mean, this is your hometown. You love it. And it is a city that has an extraordinary musical tradition, particularly classical music.
Yes, yes. Well, Mexico City, I think, shares with the beautiful city of New Orleans the fact that there are two cities where culture really runs very deep in the traditions of everyone. Whether people know it or not, you kind of grow with this idea that the music and that celebration, which includes things like food also, are part of life and are not like entertainment. They're part of what makes life interesting, and they're also part of education. So Mexico City has 4 or 5 professional orchestras.
Wow.
And an incredible amount of choruses and all different kinds of musical institutions and halls and things. And when you have 23 million people, just think about all the different audiences. I'm music director of one of the orchestras, the National Symphony, but there are the other orchestras in the city of Mexico. We used to meet kind of to say, well, if you're going to play this program, this piece in the year, well, we should avoid it because, well, like, you know, too much repetition. And after a while, we gave up because the audience doesn't mind hearing a lot of times many of the favorites that people like.
Understanding, your father was a steel company executive before he turned to music full-time. And of course, he's become quite a famous cellist, Carlos Prieto Sr.
Well,
him as a business executive?
Yeah, yeah. We all grew up in this family of musicians, but like just for fun. we are the fifth generation in a row to have this tradition. And this started with actually a great grandfather of ours in France. There's part of my family that comes from France and the other part that comes from Spain. And they kind of migrated together and started this tradition in the north of Spain of playing chamber music. And that's how my grandparents met, by the way.
Wow.
And my father grew up playing cello. He had a fantastic cello teacher and he was extremely talented as a musician, as a cellist. But he's an engineer, and so am I, by the way.
Yes.
And at some point, he decided to change, you know, but he decided later than most people do. When my father changed, it probably was traumatic for people around him and for him. It certainly was, I think, traumatic for my mother. For us, we were too little to really understand.
And so did your mother play music?
My mother actually is one of the few people in my family who was not a musician.
Oh.
But she's wise and she started playing the cello, actually, few years after marrying my dad. I don't think she wanted to do anything with the instrument other than to say, well, if I'm marrying this crazy family of musicians, I might as well get to know what they're talking about, even if it's very frustrating. And she is, I have to say, and so is my wife, incredible audience of concerts. She will give you a perspective that no other musician gives you.
Wow. What's her name?
Maria Isabel Prieto, that's her name. And she was actually born in Madrid and lives in Mexico City.
Is it true that your grandparents were friends with Igor Stravinsky, the great composer?
Well, this goes back to what Mexico City is in the sense that it's a city that attracts a lot of visitors. And we're talking about the years around the Second World War, where Europe was in shambles. United States also was under a very difficult situation. So very important musicians saw cities like Mexico City, Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, Rio as capitals of the world of music. The list of people, and we have photographs, who stayed at my grandparents' home is amazing. We're talking about people like Pablo Casals.
Oh, my word.
Like Rubinstein, like Aaron Copland, like Shostakovich.
Oh, Dmitri Shostakovich.
And Stravinsky would come to Mexico City for three straight weeks. Stravinsky went to a bullfight with my father, and my father, you know, tells of anecdotes that happened on that day. So it's a privileged situation. For example, my father's next door neighbor was Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, the painter,
yes,
and his wife.
Yes.
Okay, who were crazy people, crazy geniuses of their time. So if you imagine that neighborhood there, which is the neighborhood near the university in the south of Mexico City, it's a neighborhood where so many people were interacting, okay, and so many things were happening. That growing up there was an incredible experience.
And so what did your house sound like? Can you think of music, any kind of song in particular, a composition that you think whenever you hear it, that's my house?
Yes and no. My father would share with me his, what were then the LPs, okay?
Ah, yes, of
so
course.
So pre-CD. and I started listening to symphonies of Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. So, you know, it sounds weird, but this is my memories of early childhood. And I remember that I've always been somebody who sets goals for himself and sometimes useless goals, but goals that, you know, make you motivated to something. So one of my goals was, well, there are these symphonies by this guy that they say is so good, Beethoven. There are 9 of them, and each one has maybe 3 or 4 or 5 movements. So I'm gonna get to know these things, and you know, when I listen to a movement, I'm gonna say this is the 3rd symphony, 4th movement, or something like that.
Oh, to know them that deeply.
Yeah. When you are young, when you are a kid, your memory is incredible. Okay.
Saturday afternoon, you're lying in your bed, and you're listening to Beethoven, right? Which Beethoven, which symphony would you associate with Saturday afternoon at home?
With Saturday afternoon at home, I would associate Beethoven 6, but the Pastoral Symphony. But that's something that's an adult thought, you know? I don't think there I thought about that. I remember Saturday afternoons as the day to watch a certain soccer game, because that's another passion that I still have, is all kinds of sports. So, you know, music to me was something that I would do a little bit of every day rather than an incredible amount and anything that would take over my life. When I was 17, I thought I was gonna live all my life as an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody would have told me that, you know, a few decades later, I would be traveling the world conducting orchestras, I would have said, you're absolutely crazy.
The stuff, the Pastoral Symphony, Beethoven's Symphony No. 6, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra and Leonard Bernstein. As a child, conductor Carlos Miguel Prieto memorized all of Beethoven's symphonies. Coming up, is it ever okay to spit on a conductor? Stay tuned. This is a rebroadcast of Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We're listening to the 3rd movement of Defia's Nights in the Gardens of Spain, performed by the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra and our guest, conductor Carlos Miguel Prieto. Everybody fantasizes about living a different kind of life, but few actually try. Carlos Miguel Prieto is an exception. He first envisioned life as an engineer and industrialist. Prieto graduated from Princeton University, then earned an MBA from Harvard. Sometime later, when he was the head of a sugar company in Mexico, the maestro decided to give away the keys to the executive washroom and devote his life to music. His father had made almost the same change years before.
When I started doing what I do, I started doing it with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and kind of looking back, thinking, okay, I wasted 10, 15 years of my life, and I thought about that.
Yeah.
And it was a frustration for many years, but it was a frustration that gave me an impetus to work and to just do 10 times more, which is still with me. It's like one of these winds that just push you ahead. And also, you can tell when somebody is doing what they want to do versus what they have to do.
But the thing is, even though there is such great joy that we've been discussing in making the music that you make, you know, there's also pain. You know, the two ideas are related, the joy, the pain,
yeah.
You know, particularly with regard to creativity, you know. And I remember recently reading a news story about a poet. His name is Franz Wright, and he mm-hmm. won a Pulitzer Prize. He's an American poet. His father also was an American poet who won a Pulitzer Prize. But when his father realized that Franz wanted to be a poet, his immediate reaction was, "Welcome to hell." What was your father's reaction when you decided, you know, I'm going to do this?
It was not welcome to hell. It was both my parents kind of thought and told me, well, you better know what you're getting into because it's very, very tough. But the first reaction was go for it. And I will forever be grateful to that because that gave me the initial push and that they also said, well, we're behind you.
Yeah.
We will take care of you, et cetera, et cetera. So I admire them for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think of you as sort of a Latin American prince in many ways. You know, you come from aristocrats, you know, you're schooled at the best schools. You've got beautiful manners. You are a tucks and tails kind of guy, you know, but nobody becomes the musical director of a major orchestra without hard work and training. And you turned to the Monto School. Mm-hmm. In Maine,
yes,
for training as well as Tanglewood. Can you tell us a little bit about that school, about your experience
there?
Well,
that school, and I will never really be able to thank that school enough because it's a school that teaches you to conduct, but it teaches you to conduct from inside the orchestra. You play in the orchestra, so I play the violin and I played. You know, you play for about 10 weeks violin and you play hundreds of pieces of music, but you also have to be ready to get up and conduct them. It's very, very important psychologically for musicians to know that the person who is conducted has been in the trenches and understands that sometimes what he or she is asking is unrealistic, impossible, or is a dream because... Well, it's late at night or it's early in the morning and I'm thinking about the many problems in my life. So when you sit in an orchestra, and I actually have participated in orchestras ever since I was a little child, you experience the great joy of collective music making, but it's also a little frustration of not being an individual inside the orchestra. So in my own life as a conductor, I always try to promote individuality of musicians. When a principal oboe or when a principal trumpet or a principal horn is given the liberty to play a solo without the conductor feeding them all the information, you get an incredible creativity because almost nobody learns an instrument in order to participate in the orchestra. Most people dream of being that soloist that they admire.
That's exactly right. But I mean, what about the person who wants to play timpani? I mean, does a timpani player really believe that that person's going to be like, great virtuoso?
Of course. I mean, you know, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony or Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or Beethoven's Seventh Symphony has some of the most amazingly virtuosic timpani playing.
Really?
Oh, yes. I mean, just listen to all of Beethoven Ninth. It's almost a timpani concerto. The few timpanists who are listening to this, they know how important they are in the orchestra. Very often, the timpani leads the orchestra in some of the hardest transitions. You know, great timpanist and terrible conductor, the orchestra follows the timpani. So leadership inside the orchestra is something extremely complex and sophisticated.
Bit about the old school conducting versus new school conducting. I mean, one of your influences was Charles Brooke,
yes,
right? Who
that would be old school.
who exemplifies old school, as
yes.
you say. I mean,
yes.
This is the fellow who, you know, we always think of when we think of the conductor who's tyrannical,
yes.
who's got very strong opinions, who'll break you down
yes.
like an army drill sergeant and build you back up again.
Right.
I mean, my goodness, is it really like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was, and I experienced him for 2 years, and some of my colleagues had him as a teacher for 10. But he would yell at you in public and insult you in public as a, just as an educational tool and humiliate you. And still, I have to tell you, you probably don't notice at the moment, but years and years later, you say he was right. And that you say, as mean as he was, orchestras can be much meaner.
Really?
In a very different way. Yes. They will not say this to your face, but, you know, a badly prepared conductor who doesn't know what he wants, the results are terrible. So I remember him yelling and spitting at my face at about 2 inches, me doing the waltz from Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, and saying, that's not together, it's you. You don't feel the music. What are you thinking? What are you doing? And things like just barking at you. And after that, I've done that piece so many times. I still remember him, but in a nice way.
You know, do?
Yes. Because he was actually coming from a point of view of, well, yes, I'm very mean, but I know what I'm talking about. Somehow for me, it worked because I was able to see beyond the scare or the panic.
Yeah.
Now today, because you said that the new style, well, the new style, I would say, is less vertical. You share more decision making, like here at the LPO, which is one of the unique and fantastic things about this orchestra, is that a lot of the decisions are made by committee and
sure.
that incorporate the voice of musicians.
Right. Isn't it the only orchestra of its size that is
musician run?
Yeah,
yes,
musician
it's,
run.
And you know, we could talk a lot about that model and its great advantages and its, you know, as always, its complications. But if I had to say one thing, is that if that's the model for the new orchestra, I would be very happy, because the old style, the conductor decided everything, programs, even length of rehearsal, which would make musicians be actually not ever heard or not taking into account in any way.
It's infantilizing in many
completely.
Ways. Yeah.
But you see some of the great orchestras like Cleveland Orchestra during the 50s and 60s with George Zell. Well, one of the best orchestras to ever have existed was that orchestra. Individual musicians, absolutely great. Yet that conductor treated them like kids who didn't know anything, but was able to get incredible amount of results from rehearsing a lot, from being a tyrant, and from having them be extremely scared of him.
Wonder about that generation of conductor. These are people who went through very tough times in their lives.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, Brooke, even Monto, you know, mm-hmm. people who were sort of pushed out of Europe by war, you know, who had to give up everything, you know. And so when they find a new home someplace and they've got, you know, 10 pissants in a room who think they know something,
yes.
then, you know, I can see how a guy would just say, you can't handle the truth.
Well, this is something which is interesting, because today you still have pockets of that.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Similar like coaches in sports.
Yeah.
Some of the most admired coaches in the history of every sport have been jerks.
Oh, yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
And yet those players, you know, they say, well, he was a jerk. Good for him.
But I got the championship.
I got the championship.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, the results are actually very, very important. Yes, they are. There are conductors today who you know, they would be considered the old school, who make it a point absolutely not to have conversations with musicians because it will only lead to trouble. Okay.
Ah, fraternity only leads to trouble.
Yes. Or else if you get too close to a certain person, eventually that person will ask a favor of you that you cannot grant because you are being unfair to the rest.
Wow.
So instead of that, don't socialize. But this, thankfully, is going away because we, or at least I, did not grow up with those thoughts. In orchestras, just imagine so many centuries of tradition were very, very ingrained. There are all these tensions, which in the past would be resolved with dictatorship. And today, the world of orchestras is changing a little bit slower than other worlds, but it's changing.
Okay. So now I'm going to ask you to dispel yet another myth, okay? All right. When we watch movies about orchestras or television shows, you know, generally speaking, the conductor comes in and, you know, tells a beautiful story about the music that's to be played, you know? And then they'll tell like a personal anecdote about Ravel or Strauss or the composer, you know, and then somehow make the orchestra emotionally committed to the music. And then everything begins and it sounds fabulous.
What do you want me to dispel from there?
I leave it to you.
The truth is that there's going to be a big amen of any orchestral musician out there. The least you speak, the better.
Really?
Okay? Oh, yes. Because musicians don't come to a rehearsal to listen to the conductor. They come to a rehearsal to be led without words. So that's where gestures, that's where your own inspiration. And believe me, some of the most effective conducting comes from doing absolutely nothing. Okay, you think that the more wildly you wave your arms, the more reaction. Well, that does something at some moments, but sometimes the climax of a piece is not a huge moment, but is this hugely painful interior moment where the least you do, the better. And in other words, when a conductor does very little, the musicians really focus where the emotion is, which is inside. Okay,
it's fascinating.
So. It's not very effective to come and actually make a speech and then rehearse. It's better first rehearse. And if you need to say something to clarify something or to illustrate or maybe a joke to release tension, fine. But I have to tell you that we don't get a lot of rehearsal time. So the way we work today is just compact as much work as possible, as efficient. You correct what you can and what you think you need to do, but you always have to have in mind the concert, which sometimes is 1 or 2 days later, and you have a finite number of minutes to fix things, and sometimes the words get in the way.
Resurrection. That's Mahler's 6th Symphony in A minor, performed by the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra and Carlos Miguel Prieto. Coming up, the alpha and omega of compositions in classical music. Stay with us. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question that I've seen asked in a gangster picture.
Good.
Would you prefer to be loved or feared?
Oh my God. You know, that's a good one for a gangster, but not for me. I think I would prefer to be loved. I wish I could say that I would like to be feared, but I'm not, that's not my personality. But if I were a gangster, I would prefer to be feared.
Yes. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is a rebroadcast of Music Inside Out. In August of 2005, conductor Carlos Miguel Prieto was neither loved nor feared in New Orleans when he signed on to lead the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. It was 1 week before Hurricane Katrina, and Prieto was largely unknown. His experiences with the orchestra since the storm may prove useful to conductors elsewhere, who must help their musicians and their cities through periods of catastrophic duress. As it happens, one of Prieto's mentors, Enrique Demec, is the conductor of the symphony in Flint, Michigan, which is still experiencing terrible problems with its water supply.
I will reach out to Demec because I've read about this problem in Flint, but I'm sure that he's affected by it, and I'm sure that he can help.
Yeah.
So I'm going to reach out to
you
him.
You should.
You know, this is something that is important to keep in mind. The importance of orchestras. Orchestras should be a part of the community in a very positive way. And when they're not, it's that we're not doing our job correctly. The New York Philharmonic played Brahms' Requiem after 9/11.
That's right.
I was actually in New York for 9/11 with my wife. Yeah, I
wow.
mean, talk about timing, but we were there for about 10 days, and we were able to attend that performance of the Brahms Requiem. And on the seats, there was a piece of paper saying that in homage to the victims, the audience is requested not to clap at the end of the Requiem, which actually, if you hear the music correctly, it doesn't move you to clap. It moves you to mourn at the end. And that performance was one of the most moving performances of any piece of music that I can imagine, because it had such a meaning. And it was nationally televised, and it did a lot because it kind of rallied New York around something, and something as beautiful as an orchestra. So we have to recognize that orchestras have this incredible potential to change people's lives. If there was no orchestra in a city like New Orleans or in a city like Nashville, for example, there would be no reason for many of the instruments to ever be there.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a huge thing. I mean, in New York, it's such a big city and with different institutions that you don't need to remind people about this. In Berlin, they would not even think about the city without the orchestra. It's exactly together.
Right.
You know? And this is something that I would like to do eventually, is bring New Orleans and New Orleans feeling to cities that have no clue what real New Orleans is like. But you should see the face of people in Mexico or in Spain or in France when you say New Orleans.
Mm.
Their face lightens up. They imagine this like mecca of great jazz and great music and great food. And yet we don't do too much of that crossover. So that's one of my to-dos.
Exactly. That's pretty wonderful. That's pretty well, you know, you have a program that hopefully that you'll do again and again that features Mexican composers.
Yes.
Arturo Marquez.
Yes.
Jose Pablo Moncayo.
Yeah.
And Samuel Zyman.
Samuel Zyman.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, the music that we're talking about is music called danzón. Is that
yes.
correct? Now, danzón is what? It's a peasant dance? Folk music?
It's not. It's, I would say, popular but aristocratic. And this dance came from Cuba, from Havana, into Mexico via Veracruz. And through Veracruz, it went into Mexico City, which is one of the capitals of danzón today. It's a dance that normally is danced by older people, and always dressed in white with long attires and very elegant attires. And the gentleman doesn't move that much, and the lady is the graceful partner. It's kind of an old style. And in Veracruz, it's normally danced on Thursday afternoons, Thursday evenings at the Central Square. There's always an orchestra, and it
normally has to be live music. And this piece, Danzón number 2, has become a world sensation, about 25-year-old piece, very, very famous piece of music. But also Huapango by Moncayo, which is, you know, the national piece of music from Mexico.
Sounds lovely. It sounds well, you know, the thing that has separated a lot of New Orleans musicians, particularly traditional jazz musicians, from other musicians around the U.S., is that in New Orleans, as you well know, musicians believe in the natural marriage between music and dance.
Yes.
I love watching good dancers dance.
Yeah.
And I wish I had that. You know, my wife is a retired ballerina.
Right.
Okay, so dance is a very important part of our family, yet I can't dance. I mean, I can try, and
you can't bring it on the dance floor.
I move in rhythm. Okay, well, that part is right. The problem is how I move in rhythm. Because sometimes you can tell that somebody is a very bad dancer because they just don't get the rhythm. Okay, but then the other type of bad dancer is the one who gets the rhythm but just doesn't have the physical ability to look good, okay?
Exactly. And so what are you most proud of, you know, as the musical director for the Louisiana Philharmonic?
You know, rather than saying, like, proud of a certain performance, I'm proud of so many. I'm proud of the fact that the orchestra is actually sounding so well, so good. And I'm not saying that's a product of my tenure. The orchestra is at a very high artistic level. And it's a product of both the experience of the musicians that are remaining here, combined with some of the amazing young talent that we've been able to attract. We're doing very well in ticket sales. We have a good audience, that we have a faithful audience. The fact that we've been able to do almost all, 8 out of 9 Mahler symphonies, 10 out of 15 Shostakovich symphonies, and every conceivable difficult piece by Stravinsky and by, you know, new works, and all the premieres we've done. It's like, when I look back, I'm very, very proud of everything.
Carlos Miguel Prieto, you have said that music, it promotes generosity in musicians, and it's actually a function of generosity, you know. And also, I'm going to ask you to before we let you go, be generous one last time to us, because you've been very generous with us with your time. For the curious, the classical curious, you know, listener, I'd like you to maybe try to suggest some pieces that that person might want to listen to. There's a great philosophical writer named Alain de Botton in Britain, and he writes books that suggest philosophers that you should read at different stages of your life if you're going through different problems or
right.
different. But as a conductor, you know, if you were going to put together a program for someone, for instance, who was experiencing, I don't know, some rite of passage in life, for instance, what would you say?
Well, you know, I always think that a composer that goes straight and deep is Beethoven.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, I could, your question, you ask fantastic questions, by the way. And you make me think so much. I'm going to need a vacation after. But Beethoven is one of those composers who has the ability to go as deep as you want, yet grabs you. So I would say any symphony by Beethoven. But if you want to have an emotional roller coaster experience, just listen to Beethoven 9 once. Okay? It will move you to tears, it will inspire you, and you will not be the same after you listen to that. After you listen to that last movement talking about poetry and philosophy, and it just talks about how great man can be when we work together. So it's very inspiring. It also is the music of a man who was almost deaf, who was experiencing incredible pain, but who found in that moment the most incredible inspiration. From that piece, you can look back in time into Mozart, Jupiter Symphony, or into Bach. And I would say anything by Bach, but if you want to be incredibly inspired, listen to St. Matthew Passion. Just listen to that once, you will not be the same. And then move ahead and go to The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, which changed the world. And then I would say just pick anything by Bernstein, West Side Story if you want to have fun. And within that, you have like 4 points in the history of music which will make you be able to look at other things. And as I always say, you're never too old. You don't need to know anything to delve into this world. And there's always the opportunity for somebody to discover a new world, and classical music is one of those. And I'm sure that if you listen to something like Beethoven 9, it will open a door that will be with you forever and that will make the tough things in life be a little bit more manageable, and that will make the joyful in things in life be even more joyful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been wonderful.
You have been more wonderful.
Carlos Miguel Prieto is the musical director of the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, as well as the National Symphony of Mexico in Mexico City, and the Youth Orchestra of the Americas. He's joined us here at Marini Recording Studios. Thank you again, and come anytime. Come back.
I will.
You've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Thomas Pierce, Melissa McLean, Garrett Pittman, and Jason Ryan. Special thanks this week go to Sean Snyder and Jim Atwood of the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, the Orquesta Sinfonica Nacional de Mexico, the Youth Orchestra of the Americas, and Laura Grant. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For a complete playlist of the music from the show and more information about Carlos Miguel Prieto, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Rosa Mary Foundation, the Pinkelope Foundation, which my wife, Diana Pinkley, and I established, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Designs, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax-deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information about how you can support our program, go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.